content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. I'm going to start with some articles from AARP The Bulletin. Let's start with one entitled, Helping Kids Read for 30 Years. AARP Foundation Experience Corps celebrates an anniversary. Laurie Bowers, 73, owes a lot to being a good reader. Not everyone needs a college degree, but everyone needs to be able to read, write, and communicate, Bowers says. A former report technician for the police department, Bowers has been teaching reading to students in Buffalo, New York for 6 years as a volunteer with AARP Foundation Experience Corps. Launched in 1995, the program pairs elementary school students with older adults with one goal: improve the kids' reading skills before the end of third grade. If people don't know how to read, that limits their ability to gain an education, to have an economically sustainable job, and to retire with success and financial stability, says Miyoshi J. Moses, Vice President of Volunteer Programs at AARP Foundation. Research shows that children who can't read at grade level by fourth grade are 4 times more likely not to graduate from high school than their peers. Experience Corps volunteers hold biweekly one-on-one tutoring sessions in 18 communities across the U.S. The numbers are impressive. During the 2023-24 school year, 1,284 volunteers helped 3,659 kids become better readers before the end of third grade. The volunteers describe rewarding experiences. I have a little girl that I have worked with in the library, and the library has a cart of discarded books so that the kids can take them, said Barbara Sandust, 77, from Pinal County, Arizona. Almost every time we have reading together, before she leaves, she wants to go to that discarded cart and take a book so she can have a library at home. Stephanie Adams, 68, says, I'm teaching now in Stanfield, Arizona, which is a farming town, and a lot of those kids are the only people in their family who speak English. So they're learning to read in a new language. They're learning to interpret for their parents, and they have me there as a cheerleader. To learn more about Experience Corps volunteering opportunities, visit aarpfoundation.org/EC. Looking to volunteer in your community? Here are some other opportunities. State and community engagement. Volunteers can help AARP advocate for older adults in each of the 53 states and territories by influencing legislation to protect Social Security and Medicare, lower prescription drug costs, support caregivers, and more. Find volunteer opportunities close to you at aarp.org/volunteer-near-me. Fraud prevention. Fraud prevention volunteers educate older adults about the latest scams and ways to avoid fraud and identity theft. For more information, visit aarp.org/fraud volunteer. Driver safety. Volunteers teach AARP's award-winning Smart Driver course to help older adults stay safe on the road and continue accessing key resources within their communities. To enroll as a volunteer, visit aarp.org/ads, A-D-S, volunteer. AARP Foundation Tax Aid. This program is the largest free tax preparation service in the country. Volunteers are trained and certified to help older adults with low to moderate incomes complete and file their tax returns. To read more about the program, go to aarpfoundation.org/tax volunteer. Senior Planet is a community of older adults supporting each other as they learn to navigate our digital world. Volunteers help check in visitors to visit to Senior Planet centers, co-host online classes, or share tech skills in one-on-one or group sessions. visit seniorplanet.org/volunteer. And finally, Create the Good. This online platform connects individuals with volunteer or opportunities from AARP and other organizations. You can find it at createthegood.aarp.org. Next, let's ask Dr. Adam. A top internist and cardiologist answers your questions with surprising doctor-tested tips. Should I take an aspirin every day? Dr. Adam, there's no doubt that if you take a low-dose aspirin every day, you'll reduce your risk of a heart attack and stroke. A majority of the medical community agrees on that. But aspirin does have drawbacks. Since it alters how blood clots, it increases the risk you'll bleed more easily. And research shows this risk increases with age. That means you may get more nosebleeds and even little cuts could bleed more. But it can also increase the risk of internal bleeding in the brain or stomach, as well as the risk of developing a stomach ulcer. Before deciding whether to take a daily aspirin, you need to have a discussion with your health care provider. The answer you get will depend on factors such as your history of heart disease, your risk of heart attacks and strokes, and your age and overall health. Your doctor may suggest you take a daily low dose, most commonly 81 milligrams aspirin, for two reasons. The first is for something we call primary prevention. If you're included in this category, it means there are no heart issues in your medical history. You've never had a heart attack, stroke, or blocked arteries in any area of your body. Nor have you had coronary bypass surgery or coronary angioplasty with stent placement. There is debate over whether folks in this group who have never taken a daily aspirin and are over age 60 should begin taking one. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force says adults 60 and older should not start taking aspirin to lower their risk of a first heart attack or stroke. The guidance issued in 2022 is based on research that suggests the harms of doing so, an increased risk for bleeding in the stomach, intestines, and brain, can outweigh the benefits. If you fit in the category of secondary prevention, it means that you've already had a heart attack or a stroke, and you have underlying heart or vascular disease or diabetes. In these cases, the upside of taking aspirin likely outweighs the downside. That said, you still need to speak with your doctor in case you have other complications, such as allergy to aspirin, a bleeding or clotting disorder, or a history of gastrointestinal bleeding. Figuring out whether you should take a daily dose of aspirin can be tricky. A couple of years ago, media coverage warned people over 60 with no previous heart issues that if they were taking a daily aspirin, they were unnecessarily putting themselves in danger of bleeding. Well, my mother, who was then in her late 80s, heard that news and, without consulting me or any other physician, stopped taking her daily dose of aspirin. She had been taking one every day for decades, and during that time she never had a stroke, heart attack, stent, or bypass procedure. She had normal cholesterol, but she had prediabetes and high blood pressure. My mom also has a family history of heart disease. Within 3 months of not taking aspirin, she had a disabling stroke. My mother's story is a good lesson in why it's so important to speak with your doctor before either starting or stopping an aspirin regimen. But to be clear, a daily aspirin isn't for everyone, and it's not a magic pill that guarantees heart health. You also want to lead a healthy lifestyle. Eat a rich diet in fiber, fresh fruits and vegetables. Avoid processed food. Be physically active. Limit alcohol and don't smoke. Tame your stress and watch your weight, as well as have your blood pressure level checked. When it comes to taking care of our hearts, let's not miss a beat. This next article is one that we would probably just as soon not read. However, it is important, so I'm going to read it. the financial burden of a spouse's death. Prepare for changes involving taxes, income, and more. Having gone through this myself, I know it's important. In May 2022, a few weeks before Angela Ryan, a nurse in Chatham, New Jersey, was going to celebrate her retirement, her husband Tom died suddenly at the age of 63. "My grief was physically painful," Ryan remembers. The couple had begun meeting about an estate plan, but Ryan was still left with a deluge of financial tasks, including transferring accounts and sorting out Social Security options. "It was overwhelming to deal with, especially when you're grieving," said Ryan, now 66. On top of the emotional trauma, many surviving spouses must also cope with financial losses. Women who are widowed in the U.S., 75% of bereaved spouses are women, experience an average individual income drop of 11% annually, according to a 2020 report published by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. All too often, the financial setbacks of widowhood are unexpected. Some 41% of widows say they had not engaged in any financial planning prior to their spouse's death, according to a 2024 Trivent study. If you're facing a financial crunch after your partner's death, it's important to avoid rushing into major decisions. Panic is not a good incubator for sound money choices. Take a deep breath, then break down the tasks one by one, says Cindy Housel, president of the nonprofit Women's Institute for a Secure Retirement. To help you sort through what is already a trying time, here are some tips for overcoming the financial challenges of widowhood. Your Social Security income may fall. When a Social Security beneficiary dies, their retirement benefits end. So if both spouses were collecting monthly payments, one of those streams will dry up. If you're the widowed spouse, however, you might be able to receive a survivor benefit that's higher than your own benefit. Note that the longer a person waits to claim Social Security up until age 70, the larger the potential survivor benefit that person will leave for a surviving spouse with lower earnings. This survivor payment, unfortunately, is unlikely to match your previous income if both you and your spouse were receiving benefits. And if you claim survivor benefits before reaching Social Security's full retirement age, FRA, 67 for those born in 1960 or later, the monthly benefit will be reduced. To be eligible for survivor benefits at all, the surviving spouse must be 60 or older, married to the deceased for at least 9 months before the time of death, and not remarried before age 60. Though there are some exceptions. Survivors who are disabled may qualify at age 50. If you are caring for children from the marriage who are under 16 or disabled, you may be eligible at any age for the benefit. What to do? Contact Social Security to find out what survivor benefits you can claim. Do call several times to make sure you're getting consistent guidance, advises Lexington, Kentucky financial planner Melody Townsend, one of whose clients was misinformed by a Social Security representative. Some people might be better off claiming their own retirement benefits first and delaying the survivor benefits. For other people, the reverse might be true. You may want to hire a financial planner to help with your claiming strategy or use one of the free or low-cost claiming calculators at MaximizeMySocialSecurity.com, OpenSocialSecurity.com, or TROWEPRICE.com/Social Security. Ryan took her survivor benefit before FRA and plans to switch to her own retirement benefit at age 70 when the amount maxes out. Your claiming strategy needs to be based on your own financial circumstances, says Tom Belding, a financial planner in Chatham, whom Ryan consulted. you'll likely pay higher taxes. Surviving spouses often face a so-called widow's penalty, paying taxes at higher rates even though their income may drop after the death of the spouse. A key reason is that the status shift from married filing jointly to single filer. You can still use married filing jointly status in the tax year of the spouse's death. Single filers have tighter brackets, says Mark Lewiscom, a CPA and principal analyst at Wolters Kluwer Tax and Accounting. For example, a married couple filing jointly with $75,000 in taxable income would fall into the 12% federal tax bracket in 2025, while a single filer would land in the 22% bracket. There are a couple of exceptions. If you have minor dependents, you have a two-year period where you can still file at joint rates. And if you are caring for older or disabled relatives, you may be able to file as head of household, which is a bit more favorable than single filing status. According to the Tax Bite, your standard deduction will be cut in half. Married couples filing jointly receive a standard deduction of $30,000 in 2025, but single filers get a standard deduction of just $15,000. Those numbers are higher for people 65 and older. What to do? Talk to a tax advisor or other financial professional after your spouse's death. A fee-only financial planner will charge only for advice and won't be motivated to sell you particular financial products. There may be tax opportunities that present themselves, said Gary Slatsky, a financial advisor and attorney in New York City. Through planning, you might be able to improve your financial situation and reduce your tax liability. You may also want to take advantage of your Lowell married filing jointly tax rate while you have it to pull money from your 401k or IRA. That could reduce future required minimum distributions. The tax break you get on the sale of your home may shrink. When selling a jointly owned home, couples may be able to exclude $500,000 in profits from income. As a survivor, you have to sell the home within 2 years of your spouse's death to claim that $500,000 exclusion. To be eligible, the couple need to have owned and lived in the home at least 2 out of the 6 years preceding the death. After that, you can apply only your share of the exclusion, or $250,000, if you sell. Still, at least half of the home will get a so-called step-up in cost basis after the spouse's death, which will reduce the amount of profit and tax on gains. In community property states, both halves of the home get this step-up. To make sure the cost basis is adjusted for capital improvements, such as a new roof or addition, you'll need detailed records. What to do? Taxes are only one consideration when it comes to where you want to live. If you can continue to maintain your home and you prefer to remain where you are, that may be your best option. And if you're planning a move, take the time to research your choices. There are costs to relocating, and finding another affordable home may be difficult, says Stacy Francis, a financial planner in New York City. Your credit score may get dinged. When couples jointly use a credit card, one spouse is generally the primary account holder and the other is the authorized user. Typically, the account is canceled when the bank learns of a card holder's death. So it's a good idea for each spouse to be the primary account holder on at least one credit card. Surviving spouses may see a slight drop in their credit score. A 2023 study conducted by the researchers at Ohio State University found an average drop of 10 points among the recently widowed. The bigger threat to your credit is late or missed payments, said Emily Green, head of wealth management at Ellisvest, a women's financial planning firm. Those late or missed payments could cause a sharp drop in your score, and they will also remain on your record for 7 years. What to do? Ideally, you'll have an up-to-date record of your spouse's financial information, including account numbers and passwords, which will let you stay on top of bills. If that isn't so, you'll need to check on any debts or required payments by combing through bank statements or calling companies. And finally, you'll become a target for scammers. Fraudsters often search for the names and addresses of widows or widowers in probate documents or obituaries, said Mark Lascarrett, a financial planner in Rockaway, New Jersey. A criminal may reach out to you via phone, text, email, or official-looking postal mail. Common tactics include pretending to be a Social Security employee who needs your personal information to prevent your payments from stopping, telling you that you'll have to make a premium payment in order to collect on a life insurance policy, or claiming your deceased spouse owed a debt that must be repaid. Having lost a life partner, you may also be susceptible to romance scammers. What to do? Put financial safeguards in place, says Lua Zapata, an aging life care manager and private professional guardian in Austin, Texas. Freeze your credit account at the three major credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. Screen your calls. Be skeptical of unsolicited pitches, especially those seeking personal information or money, or offering you an investment opportunity. For messages that seem legitimate, call the provider directly using the contact info in your account statements, not the contacts supplied in emails or texts or over the phone. If you suspect a scam, call the AARP Fraud Watch Network helpline 877-908-3360. Well, for the rest of our time, let's go to AARP, the magazine, and look at some fun adventure possibilities. Explore the wild, but sleep in style. You don't need to rough it to enjoy some fresh air and serenity. It's good to get outside. Spending time in nature can lead to improved health, quality of life, and well-being in older people, according to the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health. But sleeping bags and outhouses can be less than age-friendly. The solution is glamping, glamorous camping. In 2023, cabin and glamping usage doubled from 2014, according to Campgrounds of America. Set on platforms, glamping tents have beds outfitted with linens and sometimes in-unit bathrooms and climate control. Tiny homes and boutique RV parks also can fall under the glamping umbrella. Glamping is good for people who don't want to go through all the trouble of setting everything up like they did 20 years ago with the kids, says Annette Ostrander, co-founder of Colorado's Rustic Rook Resort. State parks, typically less crowded than their national cousins, state parks can be equally scenic. One of the most popular is South Dakota's Cluster State Park. Its annual Buffalo Roundup during the last week of September attracts some 20,000 visitors, but other weeks provide a quieter experience where you can spot prairie dogs and pronghorn and bighorn sheep. Cabins at the park's resort, from about $265 per night, are scattered throughout four lodge areas, with amenities ranging from kitchenettes to just a fridge and microwave. Then there's the Presque Isle State Park in Pennsylvania. Surprises visitors who may not realize the state has a shore. This peninsular nature reserve features swimming beaches along Lake Erie. Petinato Beach provides an accessible ramp to the water's edge. Be sure to catch the glorious sunsets. An important pit stop for birds on the Atlantic Flyway, it also supports communities of purple martins and piping plovers. Visitors can head 7 miles out to the camping cabins and yurts at Presque Isle Passage, a private campground. Guests provide their own bed linens, but amenities can include in-unit bathrooms and kitchen areas. Cabins start at about $120 per night. Adirondack Park in upstate New York sprawls across some 3,000 lakes and ponds and 2,000 plus miles of hiking trails, one of the largest protected wilderness areas east of the Mississippi in the Lake George area. Hootopia Lake, George Adirondacks, tucks roomy glamping tents inspired by the domiciles of French Canadian trappers amid tall pines and beech trees. To maintain a feeling of seclusion, cars are parked in areas away from the tents. Wheeled carts help transport your gear to your forested hideaway. Glamping tents start at about $100 a night. Soulful-eyed seagrass grazing manatees are the undeniable stars of Florida's Manatee Springs State Park. In cooler weather, particularly, they gather in large numbers around the park's warm springs. Keep an eye out for them from the 80-foot-long accessible wooden boardwalk winding through the cypress forest overlooking the springs. In any season, visitors to the park can hike 8.5 miles of trails or kayak in startling clear waters. Glamping at Manatee Springs offers queen bed tents about $100 per night that sport a beachy aquamarine theme and include cooling and heating. Some nature spots seem obvious locations for glamping sites, and others are a surprise. For instance, Governor's Island in New York City, a 10-minute ferry ride from Lower Manhattan. The car-free former military base has landscaped lawns for picnicking, a 2.2-mile perimeter trail for walking or biking, and a 15,000-square-foot spa. It's like a break from the intensity of New York while still staying in New York, says visitor John O'Boyle of Westfield, New Jersey, who writes the blog The Empty Nest Explorers with his wife Debbie. And she says collective retreats, tent houses on the waterfront are hidden in plain sight because everyone walking by is looking at the epic view of the mountain range of New York City, skyscrapers, and its constellation of city lights. Tents in this place run from about $325 per night. So if you're into camping or glamping, those are definitely some good suggestions. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.